This morning, Radiance Capital versus Circle S Foods.
May it please the court. My name is Sherry Talton, and I represent Radiance Capital LLC. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for my reply. This is a simple,
No, proceed.
This is a simple yet important case that arose in 2005 when Radiance agreed to finance the purchase of a deep fryer for Circle S to use in its gas station. It's a simple case because it involves a common contract claim in which Radiance only had to show that Circle S owed a duty that it breached, resulting in damages. It's undisputed that under the party's finance agreement, Circle S owed a duty to maintain two types of insurance coverage: all risk or loss payee, and public liability and property damage, or additional insured coverage. Circle S's own evidence at trial showed that it breached this duty.
Let's work backwards through your claims. This is the second case we got this morning where somebody with a small case didn't know when to quit and is here in the Court of Appeals because they got whacked with attorney's fees. So here you've got a $381 dispute. You try it. You lose. Then you come in and argue for a new trial because you found newly discovered evidence. That newly discovered evidence was two letters from a bank that you had requested that the bank give you the day before trial. Now, I can understand why somebody might not work up a $381 case to great expense, but I don't understand why requesting something the day before trial would be good grounds for standing in the Court of Appeals arguing that the trial judge should have granted a second superior court trial on the $381 claim. So why don't you enlighten me on that?
Sure, Your Honor. Let me address the first part first. This is a claim that initially involved a small amount of damages. You're right. It was $381 for forced place insurance coverage. Over the course of the party's dispute, though, Circle S aggressively started to pursue its dispute, and it actually filed suit first in Oregon, contrary to the requirements of the finance agreement that suit be filed in Washington State King County Superior Court, as the court concluded in its findings of fact and conclusions of law. At that point, Your Honor, Radiance had no choice but to pursue litigation in Washington State. Throughout the course of litigation, obviously, the case didn't settle. So the reason that we're here today is not just for the $381, but now, in hindsight, Radiance has incurred substantial damages for the cost of the contract and the cost of enforcing it in Oregon and in this jurisdiction. To your second point about the motion for reconsideration and the evidence that we requested on the eve of trial, I don't think that we need that evidence to win this case. And in fact, I didn't plan on mentioning the motion for reconsideration today. At the end of the day, you have evidence, clear evidence, of a duty under the finance agreement for Circle S to provide two types of insurance coverage. Circle S's own insurance policies showed that it breached that duty. In 2009, 2010, those policies have no loss payee coverage, and the additional insurance coverage was defective. And you have proof of damages because we had to pay for our own forced placed insurance, which was $381, the $150 UCC transfer fee, and the cost and fees associated with enforcing this contract. Paragraph 18 of the contract allows us to recover those costs and fees. There you have clear duty, clear breach, clear evidence of damages. I think this case is finished at that point. The reason that it wasn't in the Superior Court was because the Superior Court found that Radiance was required to provide notice and an opportunity to cure any deficiencies in the coverage or the proof of coverage. But that's simply not based in the contract. There's not a single provision in the party's finance agreement that required Radiance to provide any notice or any opportunity to cure. Even though Radiance did have a standard policy of providing its customers this courtesy, nothing in the finance agreement required this. In fact, paragraph 13 is the paragraph that addresses Radiance's ability to get forced place coverage, its own insurance, to protect its security interests, and there's not a single mention of notice in that paragraph. Paragraph 17 of the party's finance agreement also relates to the remedies available to Radiance on default, and that says that in the event of a default, Radiance has the right to immediately declare due all amounts owed without notice, and it specifically says that. So the court's conclusion that Radiance was not entitled to judgment because it should have given notice is just erroneous. And I really think that I need to go no further to win the case. However, the contract also indicated another duty that Circle S breached, which was to provide proof that it was maintaining both types of coverage throughout the period of the contract. That proof is indicated in the notice. On the same day that Circle S executed the finance agreement, which was the main transactional document, it also executed a document called Notice to Provide Insurance. In that document, Circle S instructed its own insurance agent, Mr. Short, to provide Radiance with proof that it was maintaining, and I'll quote from the second paragraph, all risk insurance and public liability and property damage insurance. This language directly mirrors the finance agreement. The third paragraph of the notice also indicates that Circle S agrees to deliver to Radiance proof of the required insurance as provided above, with an effective date of October 7, 2005. So I think, contrary to what the Superior Court concluded, these documents are entirely consistent with one another and they reference each other. The court's finding of fact was that the notice did not reference the finance agreement, but this is simply not true. The very first paragraph of the notice states that Circle S has entered into an equipment finance agreement with Radiance Company. Additionally, the finance agreement itself contemplates the existence of the notice. In paragraphs 13 and 23, the agreement notifies Circle S that there will be additional information not specifically referenced in the finance agreement that Radiance will request and that Circle S will be required to provide. So I think, one more thing, the party's course of conduct indicates also that there was a duty to provide proof of maintaining coverage because Mr. Short continued to send in certificates of insurance attempting to show that Circle S had maintained both types of coverage, when in fact we know from their insurance policies in 2009 and 2010 that they didn't do that, and we know from the numerous certificates of insurance that were insufficient that they didn't do that. The second part of that duty is not just that they had to provide proof of obtaining coverage, but they had to continually update that proof as the contract went forward. And that's supported by paragraph C of the notice, which says that Circle S has to give 10 days notice of any cancellation or revision of the policy.
But if they had that notice and they didn't give you notice of cancellation or revision, the original notice was accurate. How is there evidence of a breach?
The evidence of the breach is that in 2009 and 2010, the insurance policies lack loss payee coverage. And I think it's an independent breach that they didn't provide us the 10-day notice in 2009 and 2010. We didn't argue that at trial, though.
May it please the court, Andrew Kinsler here on behalf of Circle S. I think the court has focused in on the critical issues, and there are just a few things that we need to recognize that are erroneous in what's being stated by Radiance. Circle S signed this contract in 2005 and agreed to provide the insurance that's not specified in the contract what insurance is going to be required, other than you're going to have loss payee coverage for the property and you're going to have liability coverage in amounts that the lender shall reasonably require. So at that point, you don't really know what's required. So the lender, quite appropriately, this is Appendix B to the appellant's brief, sent out a notice of insurance that would have to be provided. And that notice said, as Judge Applewick, you just pointed out, three things. An endorsement showing that the all-risk coverage is in place. An endorsement showing the liability coverage is in place. And the insurer is told that they have to provide 10 days notice to the lender if that ever changes. So you have to provide these two types of coverage, insurer, and you have to provide 10 days notice if that ever changes. So that was the initial requirement, and everyone agrees that that was met. And so for all of 2006, the lender was happy with the insurance coverage, and then for all of 2007, up until July 1 of 2007, the lender agrees all of the necessary insurance was in place. Lender agrees. But nonetheless, in January of 2007, 6 months before the lender says there was any problem, they started adding an insurance premium to their bill to my client. And my client starts paying the invoice, crossing off the insurance coverage. I've already got insurance coverage. Why am I paying these guys for insurance coverage? So it pays the bill other than the insurance portion. And then as of July 1, 2007, now the lender says for some reason they're now not happy with the insurance coverage that's in place, even though they have a promise from the lender, from the insurer, to give them 10 days notice of any change. The certificates of insurance throughout 2006 through 2010, when it's all paid off, there's a certificate of insurance showing the same policy is in place and renewed throughout the period of time. Every certificate of insurance shows continuation of that policy. Now, the lender says...
Has the same policy number on it?
Same policy number throughout the entire period.
But can't addendums and endorsements vary even though the same policy is in place?
They can.
So that isn't evidence that no change occurred or that despite change, no notice was given.
The lender was entitled to rely on the notice provision, and there never was any notice to the lender of any change in the coverage that they required. So they never received any such notice. Now,
but typically when you renew a policy, there would be a new certificate issued.
And there was.
And their concern is the certificate does not indicate a continuation of the second type of insurance.
The certificate.
Why was it so hard to straighten that out?
I don't know, because the lender and the insurance agent were communicating directly, and so they were back and forth and sending new certificates, and some of the certificates were okay with the lender, some of the certificates the lender was thinking, you know, that's not quite right. But it was the contract provided that any notice required under the contract be in writing. And so that, I think this Appendix B to the appellant's brief is very important for three reasons. One is it was completed at the outset of the contract. It set forth what is the initial insurance that's required, and it was complied with. Second, item C is the requirement of notice of any cancellation or revision that would affect the lender's interest. That was never, they never received any such thing. And they never sent this exhibit again. This is a form. All they have to do is send this to the insurance company and say, this is what we need. And they never did it. They never sent a written notice saying they had a problem with the information in their hands regarding the insurance. So they didn't do it. Therefore, the court found there was no written notice of a problem. Again, the contract doesn't say what the insurance coverage has to be. So in order to set forth what's reasonably required, the lender needs to send a notice setting forth what's reasonably required, which they never did after the notice requirement that they sent out at the outset and that my client complied with and provided the lender with everything they needed. So as a result, there was substantial evidence for the court to find, as the court did find, that if you have a problem and you want different proof of insurance, you need to send a written notice. They didn't do that. So they don't have an argument. And they say that there is proof from the 2009 and 2010 period that they were not named as loss payee in those policies. And that's correct. If you look at those policies, they don't have Radiance listed as loss payee. But you do have certificates of insurance for 2009 and 2010 showing that they are loss payee. So the insurer is sending Radiance certificates of insurance saying you are loss payee under this insurance policy. That's why when we started the trial in this case and their trial brief, they didn't complain about loss payee because they had loss payee certificates. They complained about not being an additional insured. That's what's in their trial brief. The breach was not being an additional insured. So the policies came in and show them as an additional insured. So then they changed and they said, well, wait a minute. Now at trial, not during the period of time they were spending their own money buying insurance, but now at trial they're saying, wait a minute, in retrospect, there's a technical problem here. You guys didn't have us as loss payee. But the evidence was the opposite, because the certificates of insurance are from the insurer to the lender. You can rely on this. You are a loss payee on this contract. And they have signed certificates from the insurer making them a loss payee. So they have everything that they were entitled to, and yet they want this $7.81, and they will not release the property to my client without paying whatever amount they say they want to be paid. And so we end up with this dispute. So there was no breach by my client, no proof of breach at trial. The trial judge carefully went through, made findings and conclusions that there was no written notice to my client of any problem under the contract, and that in the absence of that, my client was never given opportunity to cure whatever problem there was, and that the proper insurance was in place, and that as a result, judgment in favor of my client and against the lender should be affirmed. Thank you.
Proceed.
Thank you. I'd like to address a minor but I think important point first, and that is that Radiance was not a lender in this case. The record shows that Radiance was the purchaser of the Fryer. Radiance financed that purchase in exchange for monthly payments from Circle S. So the assumption that this was a lease, I think, was one of the driving assumptions that led to some error in both the trial court and in the briefing. The second point that I'd like to make is that we did admit at trial that Radiance made a billing error for charges between January 1, 2007, and I believe May 31, 2007. We have no explanation for why that billing error exists. We're not claiming those amounts as damages, and the fact that that billing error exists goes to nothing other than the amount of damages that we're entitled to. The third point I'd like to talk about, I think, is the most important, and that is this idea that Radiance was getting certificates of insurance that showed that it was a loss payee. Well, that's kind of the whole point, is that the certificates of insurance were making misrepresentations about what the actual insurance coverage was. And the proof of that is if you look at Appendix C, which was Exhibit 16 at the trial court, the certificate of insurance for February 26, 2010 actually lists Radiance as the loss payee, but the insurance policy itself for 2010 does not. And the certificate also shows no additional insured coverage, but the 2010 policy lists Radiance as an additional insured for office equipment rather than a fryer or restaurant equipment or kitchen appliance. So I think at the end of the day, Radiance was justified in its fear that its security interest wasn't being covered. Ask yourself this question. In February 26, 2010, if Circle S's gas station had burnt to the ground and killing several people and causing property damage, Radiance would have been on the hook under the policies that were in place that Circle S itself admitted into trial. We were justified in our fear of needing coverage to protect our interest, and we requested and required Circle S to meet its obligations under the contract to show us that it had both types of insurance coverage and to give us proof, as we requested it, of that coverage. I think it's a very simple case. It did go, we did have some rabbit trails in the trial court, but here I think the issues are clear. There was a duty, it was breached, we have damages. The superior.
I think counsel argues that Appendix B advised them, advised Circle S of what they needed to have, and that there was nothing further from Radiance saying you need to have something different than what B requires.
Thanks for reminding me about that, Judge Becker. I think the obvious answer to that is that we sent 49 invoices showing a charge for insurance premiums. Mr. Singh testified at trial that by the first invoice, he knew that Radiance had a problem with this coverage, and he assured Radiance that it would be fixed by his insurance agent, but it never was.
What particular problem did it advise him that Radiance had?
Each invoice said there was a charge for insurance. That's all it said.
It didn't say that your certificates or what you have in your policy was inadequate for any particular reason.
No, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. That concludes.